Natural Living with Gary Null, exploring the nature and politics of medicine, health, nutrition, and the environment. And now your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to the program. Today, we'll be continuing with the ongoing series, AIDS, a Second Opinion. We're re-examining the deconstruction of the myths surrounding HIV and AIDS. Today is part five in this series. In a moment, I'll go over a number of the medical issues in great detail that I consider have not been properly examined in their relationship to AIDS. But it might be worthwhile to keep in mind that the questions around AIDS turn on more than simply the rightness or wrongness of scientific hypothesis. Ethical, financial, and therapeutic questions are implicated as well. No one reasonable in this field would regret spending money if we ended up with a cure. Yet by the same token, in a world of limited resources, every dollar spent on research that is traveling down a blind alley is $1 taken away from subsidizing the research that might be totally beneficial. Quite a few doctors and medical researchers have pointed to the perverse equation in AIDS study, whereby it seems more and more money is spent for less and less enlightenment. November of year 2000, in a pamphlet from the AIDS awareness group HEAL, a lot of money, according to them, and time are being involved in this research. The group estimates that in 1984, when we had our first pronouncement that HIV was the so-called cause of AIDS, until now we have over 150,000 scientific papers published on HIV. Quote, though more research money has been spent on HIV than on the combined total of all other viruses ever studied in human history, there is still no scientific evidence that HIV is the cause or that AIDS has a viral cause. Unquote. This thought is amplified by Dr. David Rasnick, a scientist with 20 years' experience, who feels the amount of money spent fruitlessly in trying to prove HIV causes AIDS has convinced him of the opposite premise. He says, quote, the only reason why I'm absolutely convinced is because HIV/AIDS is the most studied thing in all of science, absolutely the most studied thing in the history of science. Unquote. Yet as he sees it, all this study and all the billions upon billions of dollars spent on it have not produced a shred of evidence in favor of the Gallo hypothesis. When the HIV causal hypothesis was first advanced, many leads looked promising that today seem played out. This is the opinion of the researchers, Dr. Thomas, Dr. Kerry Mullis, and Dr. Johnson, all either Nobel Prize winners or professors emeritus in molecular biology, virology, from major universities. They summarized their argument as the following, quote, the present stalemate contrasts dramatically with the confidence expressed in 1984, unquote. Then Gallo said HIV was directly eliminating healthy cells. The government foresaw that a vaccine would be available in at most 2 years. Then 10 years later, after spending billions of dollars, quote, no vaccine was in sight. And the certainty about how the virus destroys the immune system has dissolved into confusion, unquote. Then years later, new advances supposedly in vaccines. Then these vaccines don't play out either. On the bright side, one could say we've learned scads about HIV as a virus, but that little of that is of consolation for those expecting knowledge about treatment of the disease. This was a point made by Dr. Charles Thomas, who I interviewed 4 years ago. He said, in a limited sense, you can't say that all the papers are wrong. We know a good deal more about HIV than we do about any other virus in the whole world. So in the narrow sense, the molecular biology of HIV might be perfectly valid undertaking. But what is not correct is to say that the outcome of this research is in any way going to benefit the people who are classified as AIDS victims, unquote. Dr. Robert Root Bernstein put it epigrammatically. He said, quote, by the end of the century, we will know everything there is to know about HIV, and we will know nothing about AIDS, unquote. According to Dr. Menard Fields, it was the restricted scope of the undertaking set off by the Gallo Conference in Bethesda, Maryland, that has condemned the enterprise in advance. Fields, professor of molecular biology at Harvard and senior member of the HIV/AIDS Research Establishment, directs our attention to this limitation in an article in Nature magazine where he states, quote, the nation's $1.3 billion AIDS research program is on the wrong track, unquote. This is because the program has been centered on, quote, drug development and vaccine programs that have little scientific rationale. Real scientific progress comes more from basic research into how the body and its immune system operates, since we still have too many serious gaps in our fundamental knowledge to know how to prevent and treat AIDS, unquote. Nobel Prize winner Dr. Curry Mullis, in fact, believes that money has ended up producing more rather than less confusion about AIDS and HIV. Mullis invented a technique that is used to virtually every HIV study. But looking at the money spent without result, he sardonically noted, quote, the mystery of the damn virus has been generated by a $6 billion a year that we spend on it. You take on any other virus and spend $6 billion and you can make up some great mysteries about it, too. Let's take a look at the ethics behind all this. The most distressing aspect of the highly debatable proposition that HIV equals AIDS is that after it has been trumpeted by the media and the establishment doctors as an unquestionable truth, it appears as a death sentence to those who find themselves HIV positive. Celia Farber outlines the climate of hysteria that this creates. She says, they call HIV the AIDS virus, and it's this generation's symbol of terror. It has come to rule us, our lives, our relationships, unquote. Aside from the fact, which we will be taken up a little later in detail, that tests for HIV's presence in a person's blood are often unreliable, it has not yet been proven that those who are HIV positive will get AIDS. In consequence, untold suffering is spread to those positives who implicitly trust the counsels of the establishment. Dr. Alfred Hassig examines the ethical implications, arguing in an essay in a German magazine, quote, never in the long history of medicine has a collective death sentence been passed, as is the case today with AIDS, unquote. He feels basic human rights are violated when doctors discourage HIV-positive patients with overly pessimistic prognoses. Further, he believes, quote, many HIV carriers have ended their presumed hopeless psychological situation by committing suicide, unquote. In an interview, he calls doctors to remember their pledge. It is the duty of every medical doctor to preserve life at any cost, the Hippocratic Oath, and not death-curse people based on any tests so as they are so frightened they kill themselves. There are programs to prevent AIDS. I've already said that. Lacking a decent theory of how HIV acts to cause AIDS, there is less chance of developing a workable cure given that scientists will be proceeding by hit-and-miss method. Let's flesh out some of the thought in the second and third parts of my following programs on this. I'll consider this at greater length. So here I'm only going to suggestively stretch the dimensions of the problem, which can be illustrated by two examples. The needle exchange program, where drug users are encouraged to turn in used hypodermics for sterile ones, assumes HIV can be spread by using infected needles. And since those behind this program believe HIV causes AIDS, for them making sure those needles are sterile is the priority. Yet what if, as others argue, HIV is the result of an immune system devastated by drug addiction? Then, as Duisberg and Ellison and others argue, quote, sterile needles may limit the transmission of hepatitis and other infectious diseases, but they do not guard against the immunosuppressive effects of heroin, cocaine, and overuse of antibiotics. Duisberg also notes how foolhardily it is to give HIV-positive people a toxic drug to eliminate the HIV virus, if indeed the virus is not the root of AIDS. He says, the HIV-AIDS hypothesis has become a threat to public health. He feels because it accounts for the administration of cytotoxic DNA chain terminators, like AZT, originally designed to kill growing human cells for chemotherapy, that AZT should not be prescribed. Again, the argument is that if it is a weakened immune system that is responsible for AIDS, then the presence of HIV is not the issue. Distorting the immune system even further, depleting it with drugs like AZT, is going to do more harm than good. Both of these criticisms of current treatment of AIDS, I'll go into substantial detail later on. I'd like to take an in-depth critique of current AIDS orthodoxy. It's time to move to another level and bring a more searching analysis to some of the claims of the orthodox medical establishment. Many more than you might suspect have already been wrecked by history, as was the idea put forth in 1984 that within 2 years a vaccine would be on the market. Just as exploded, we will see, have been such ideas as that AIDS would spread to the general population outside the initial target groups. It has not. And that the way HIV damages the immune system would quickly be worked out. It was not. Others are affected by multiple problematics of logic and inability to generate any proof in scientific experiments. Let me give you an example of this. Several years ago, when I was at the Institute of Applied Biology, we were examining the work done at other institutes where they tried to replicate HIV, could not, in animals. So they took the animals closest to humans, which would be the orangutans and chimpanzees and monkeys, and tried as they would to get them infected. Over a period of 5 years, not a single animal was able to be infected by direct intramuscular implant and IV. They would just do everything they could to put as much HIV into these animals' bodies as possible. None of the animals got AIDS. So then someone came up with a bright idea. This goes back about 10 years ago now. Let's depress the body's immune system so grossly that then it might get sick. Then we can call that sickness AIDS. So what did they do? They gave massive amounts of chemotherapy to the chimpanzees, enough that in normal circumstances it would kill them. But before they died, just before they died, clever scientists that they are, they then injected them with some HIV, and lo and behold, when the animals were so sick from the chemotherapy, they said, ah, we finally have, for the first time after 12 years, we've been able to create AIDS in an animal. Not true. They have never, ever, ever, ever created AIDS in an animal with a healthy immune system. But that they don't tell you. But because we were aware of the research methodology, I was appalled. That's tantamount to scientific fraud. And yet that happens every single day around the United States. In fact, the fraud of science today virtually is endemic. Mention science, fraud is hand in hand with it. Special interest is hand in hand with it. Conflict of interest is hand in hand with it. Deceit, all hand in hand. So even when they tell us they've discovered something, you got to question them. You got to look at how they did it, because there's always someone behind the scenes playing some games. Now, it may seem that a number of the more extravagant claims made by the dissidents, such as that all the money spent on HIV research might just as well have been thrown down a rabbit hole, or that some respected scientists seem to be driven more by a lust for fame than a desire to improve our understanding of human biology, are to be reckoned as argumentation, hyperbole, rather than serious claims. All I will say on this is, see if you hold this opinion after looking in more depth at what we brought out today and in our next two programs. When I try to bring the extravagant claims of the establishment to the bench of justice. A Robert Gallo, he is the kingmaker of the AIDS establishment. In 1987, Robert Gallo's name was again prominently featured in the news. It involved another press conference, although this time it was not personally, he was not personally present, taking place on March 31st at the White House, where President Clinton and the French Premier Jacques Chirac met to sign a truce. The men signed a pact by which scientists in each country shared the credit for discovering the so-called HIV virus and subsequently a blood test to detect its presence. The disputants were Gallo, the National Cancer Institute for the United States, and Luc Montagnier at the Pasteur Institute in France. This was a purely diplomatic argument, and hence an agreement was reached, which did not try to adjudicate the claims of each scientist, but simply allowed both to share the glory and the substantial amount of money, estimated now to be about $10 million a year, accruing as royalties to the HIV test each had developed. As the New York Times put it, the agreement, quote, left it to historians to sort out the credit. Rather than rendering judgment on who discovered what, the agreement contained a chronology, which indicated that Montagnier's group had isolated the virus well before Gallo's team, which independently isolated a similar virus. Gallo's teams claimed credit, however, for being the first to say the virus caused AIDS. Before continuing to sift the epidemiological and scientific evidence concerning AIDS and HIV, let's spend a few moments looking into the underpinnings of this scientific joust. We need to be clear about the questions and hence the reasoning for this historical excursion. It is not to cast aspersions on Gallo, although he comes out looking far from heroic. Remember, our overall purpose is to evaluate the HIV causes AIDS equation and related claims. Mudslinging will not settle anything, although, as I noted earlier, Gallo and others in the establishment have been known to stoop to it. Ad hominem arguments do not work in legitimate science. Suppose Robert Gallo, or Peter Duisberg for that matter, was found with his hand in the poor box of a local church. Sad as this might be as a comment on either's morals, it would have little bearing on the results of any scientific experiment either man carried out. Instead, if we find out Gallo's lab occasionally played fast and loose with the truth, the conclusions we want to draw relate to what this says about the state of modern science as a whole. Jockeying and rivalry between competing scientific agencies and the idols of the cave. Scientific research is expensive, so it demands funding. To get that funding, it helps to have a high profile. To get a high profile, it's good to be willing to put on a media sideshow, as Gallo did in 1984, and to put on these sideshows is helpful to have breakthrough discoveries to publicize. Don't get me wrong, I'm all in favor of breakthroughs. However, let us bear in mind the sage advice of Dr. Bernard Fields, quoted in my last program. He argued that the basic research that is needed to actually grasp the functioning of the human body is not being done because it's not flashy. It's not productive of fast results. Instead, as we will see, quick fixes are the order of the day, and the lab like Gallo's will cut corners and act in ways that most would consider wrong to achieve a breakthrough in media terms. What I'm going to argue then is not so much that Gallo's group was dishonest, but a much more damning statement that it is representative of many other high-profile medical research centers. The situation is parallel to that of those corporations that put the achievement of high quarterly results at the top of their agenda in lieu of growing the company with plans for long-term stability and enhancement. In the one case, the economy, in the other case, knowledge, suffers. We know a lot about what Gallo's lab did toward discovering the HIV virus since it has been the subject of a number of government investigations, most particularly a two-year inquiry by the Inspector General's Office of the Department of Health and Human Services, a three-year investigation by the Federal Office of Research Integrity, and one conducted by Dr. John Dingell, as head of the House subcommittee that oversees the National Institutes of Health. All of these groups and others I will mention found rather discouraging facts about both the history of Gallo's discovery of HIV virus cells and the subsequent patent application process for a blood test to determine if a person has the virus. I also want to look at Gallo the man, his earlier career, including his fall from grace and reinstatement, his promotion of infighting and backbiting, and his one-sided obsession with retroviruses. This look will give us some insight into the operation Idols of the Cave. According to Bacon, such figures, quote, are the idols of the individual man. For every man, for every one, has a cave or a den of his own, which refracts or colors the light of nature, which is to say, each person's temperament and experience clouds his or her perceptions. Let's look at Gallo's cave. Gallo's background was in cancer research. He was inspired to work on cancer by the death of his younger sister, who was carried off by leukemia when Gallo was 14, but was dissuaded from working directly with patients by how troubled he was by his first assignment for the National Cancer Institute on a ward of children dying of leukemia. Knowing that some animal centers and some animal cancers were caused, were doing research on the causes of cancer by viruses, Gallo directed his research in that direction through the 1970s, trying to see if any viruses could be responsible for human cancers. He was responsible for a number of breakthroughs, being one of the number who isolated the first retroviruses, and also for having, to his credit, the cultivation of a cell line for growing human viruses. Since viruses do not really live outside the cells, it can be seen that they will be harder to cultivate in the laboratory than, say, bacteria. Independent bacteria will grow by themselves in a proper medium. But viruses will grow only inside host cells. However, if the virus is to be grown, is a harmful one, it will continually kill the host which are sponsoring it, thus finding a way to cultivate a line of living cells that provide viable homes for a type of virus and can be successfully replenished was central to viral research. Gallo's star was eclipsed, however, in 1976. Quote, it appeared that he had discovered a new virus, and proudly Gallo announced that to the world, when it turned out that an animal germ had contaminated his cell line and there was no new virus, Gallo's reputation plummeted, unquote. However, he recouped his standing a couple of years later when he did find a human virus that played a role in a rare form of leukemia. He called it human T-cell leukemia virus. Bacon's idols of the cave are rooted in both positive and negative impressions that have marked the individual. Positive experiences shape the direction of one's interest. Men become attached to certain particular sciences and speculation, either because they fancy themselves the authors and inventors thereof, or because they are bestowed their greatest pains upon them and become the most habituated to them. That's according to Francis Bacon. In April of 1983, when Gallo first became interested in AIDS, before he had done any research on the topic, Randy Schultz reports to him, reports him saying, quote, I believe a retrovirus is involved, and we're going to prove or disprove it within a year. By August, not only was he claiming that he had been justified in thinking the disease was caused by retrovirus, but that HTLV, the same virus he had previously identified as causing cancer, was behind it. To other doctors, this seemed wrong-headed in that the HIV and cancer were at opposite ends of a continuum in how they damaged the body. The first, HIV killing cells, the second, making them overactive. Later, Gallo discarded this particular idea, but he would maintain at Bethesda and after that HIV, then called HTLV-3, was still part of the HTLV family. Later, retreating even further, he changed the meaning of the acronym so that the L no longer meant leukemia, but lymphoma. The value of Bacon's intuitions are certainly evident here. Gallo had recouped his reputation by discovering HTLV. Quote, men become attached, he says, unquote. Remembered two things which, quote, they fancy themselves the authors thereof. Unquote. Well, once Gallo found one retrovirus, he began finding them everywhere. This is not to say here is proof that he was wrong, but it does indicate how extra scientific values influence the direction of beliefs. This is why the Elizabethan counseled, let every student of nature take this as a rule, that whenever his mind seizes and dwells upon a particular satisfaction, is to be held in suspension, and that so much of the more care is to be taken in dealing with such questions to keep the understanding even and clear. I've talked about how negative experience also registers forcefully in the individual. Savor this passage. Back when Gallo was favoring the hypothesis that HTLV caused AIDS, he was disturbed by reports of Pasteur Institute discoveries. According to Randy Schultz, quote, privately, he spread the word that the French isolates were not human isolates at all, but contaminants from other viruses kicking around their labs, unquote. Sincere as his beliefs may have been, we can see that making this supposition about the French, he is reviving the accusation made against him at the time of his flub viral isolation experiment. So we see that unless screened out, personal history enters into scientific practice and may urge one to support theories such as the supposing HIV causes AIDS that do not merit such backing on more objective grounds. There is also a role for basic character traits to play in determining scientific progress. Later, when we talk about the culture of laboratories, I'll bring up some of Gallo's, such as illustrate characteristics that were off-putting in the adventures of bureaucratic warfare that occurred between all these people. Let's take a look at the virus used in Gallo's lab. There's no question that Gallo's earlier work in developing cell cultivation techniques and in finding a legitimate disease causing virus influenced the French researchers at the Pasteur Institute to look for a virus as the base of AIDS. It is not disputed that the scientists at the Pasteur Institute, Francois Béra, Jean-Claude Sherman, and Luc Montagnier, were the first to isolate the AIDS virus. When the group sent a paper to Science in April of 1983 describing their early results, isolation of the virus from one patient with a swollen lymph gland, Gallo, according to journalist Seth Roberts, quote, who reviewed the paper for Science before publication, added a sentence to the introduction. It stated the French virus, quote, appears to be a member of the human T cell leukemia family, i.e. the family of the viruses Gallo discovered. The main text of the paper said no such thing. To give Gallo his due, however, what Roberts is calling the introduction was in fact an abstract, a condensed report of the findings, which Science includes with each of its articles, but which Montagnier had neglected to provide. Moreover, we might add that Montagnier's requested that Gallo be the reviewer. In any case, Gallo did egregiously add a sentence connecting the French discovery with his research. Gallo's lab asked for and was courteously given samples of the virus the French had isolated. Once the French virus arrived, Gallo's lab got it to grow. With the knowledge thus gained, according to one source, the Gallo researchers were able to isolate other examples of the same type of virus from AIDS patients. But the French virus grew best, and it was the French virus that Gallo's lab used for their research. Gallo's lab notes, obtained by the Chicago Tribune, showed that the French virus was renamed a couple of times, apparently to hide the fact that it was being used at all. The bone of contention here is whether Gallo's lab, which admits it used the virus of the Pasteur Institute, as an example, then isolated its own retrovirus from AIDS patients' blood and used them to conduct its experiments. Gallo's group does not say it was first, but does say it autonomously discovered the virus in the blood of people with AIDS. Its findings about HIV causative role, if true, would be valid no matter what sample were used, but Gallo's avowal that he had independently found the retrovirus would seem less believable if to do so, he used the same blood sample the French had used. Moreover, it is a matter of pride. It certainly wouldn't look good if the American lab can't even isolate its own samples and had to rely upon the French handouts, especially in that, as noted, Gallo had been a pioneer in perfecting ways to grow retroviruses. But since that's precisely what they did have to do, used the French sample. Given that they wanted to quickly make a media splash and culturing a viable sample was very time-consuming, they did the next best thing. They pasted their own labels on Pasteur Institute blood and pretended they had done the work. This, at least, was the conclusion of the three-year investigation of the Federal Office of Research Integrity. According to New York Times report, office, quote, found that Dr. Robert Gallo had intentionally misled colleagues to gain credit for himself through pretending not to use the French samples and diminish credit due to the French competitors, unquote. But putting all the blame on Gallo would be like saying Stalin alone was responsible for the rise of Russian state communism. There had to be collaborators all along the line, and there were. Looking at this reveals a shockingly pervasive infidelity to the goals of science as part of the powers that be. A separate investigation conducted by a subcommittee of the House of Representatives discussing the actions within Gallo's lab, called the LTCB, said, quote, a substantial body of circumstantial evidence shows that at the very inception of their seminal experiments, the LTCB scientists knew or had reason to know that the virus they were working with and claimed as their own was indeed the Pasteur Institute's virus, unquote. Not only did these scientists disregard this knowledge, a sin of omission, they actively kept it from the public's attention, a sin of commission. The subcommittee report continues, quote, the LTCB scientists' own actions showed there was something to hide, that the LTCB scientists knew there was something to hide, and that they made every effort to do exactly that, unquote. The report unearthed that Dr. Popovich, who had oversight over the National Cancer Institute lab where Gallo worked in the experiments with the Pasteur Institute virus, and actually performed many of them, attempted to give the proper credit to the Pasteur scientists. Quote, in the first draft of his report, this was the paper that the famous Bethesda press conference was heralded. Popovich explicitly acknowledged he had used the French virus. But Gallo chastised him, extensively revised the paper, removed all references to the Pasteur Institute, as if this was their own. This seems to exonerate Popovich, while indicating a surprise lack of ethics on the part of Robert Gallo. But think more deeply. Does a real scientist knowingly cover up the truth because his boss tells him he should? Popovich is equally damned by this finding. The corruption does not just extend to the scientific community. There was one responsible scientist found in the story, Dr. Gerald Myers, of the Los Alamos National Laboratory in northern New Mexico, who specializes in the genetic analysis of viruses. According to the Chicago Tribune, quote, Myers compared the genetic codes of the French and the American AIDS viruses, which turned out to be exactly the same. This would be impossible if there were two individual viruses involved, albeit of the same type. He, quote, determined they were not independent discoveries, but undoubtedly come from the same patient, unquote. He shot off a letter to senior officials of the National Institutes of Health. Myers' memo was promptly buried in the National Institutes of Health files, where it remained until it was accidentally discovered late last year by investigators to Representative John Dingell. The report of Dingell's staff on the situation was the most damning of all. According to the Tribune, quote, the interment of the Myers memo represents a single example, albeit a particularly egregious one, of what the report describes as a, quote, continuing cover-up of successive administrative of the role played by American scientists in discovery of the AIDS virus. While the Department of Health and Human Services, quote, did its best to cover up the wrongdoing, the failure of the entire scientific establishment to take any meaningful action left the disposition of the scientific truth to bureaucrats and lawyers with neither the expertise nor the will essential to the task, unquote. The pressure on the bureaucrats to make Gallo look like the Columbus of AIDS, one can imagine, did not come but from scientific but political quarters. I noted already that the Bethesda press conference was to be juggled to fit a government department's head schedule. On this score, Schultz reports on Gallo's finding of HIV, quote, rather than be heralded as an accomplishment of the National Cancer Institute or the National Institutes of Health, credit for the breakthrough was going to go to the Reagan administration, The announcement could counter liberal criticism the government had dragged its feet on AIDS funding. Schultz amply documents that the Reagan government had constantly backpedaled on AIDS funding, generally proposing minuscule amounts, amounts which were up by the legislature. Thus, as Schultz suggests, the Reagan government would use a scientific finding as a way of grossly distorting the truth and picturing itself as seriously dedicated to facing the disease. Highly ironic, isn't it, that a small lie, the Gallows Lab developed its own retrovirus samples, is used to further a bigger lie, the government gave a damn about an illness that attacked marginal groups. And then there's a whole, I will not go into the depth on the patent disclosures, which I have researched in some depth. That will be on my webpage, over almost 50 pages of material to give you an idea of how the politicking of that occurred. My interest is rather just to show you, if you are not aware of it, that we should question virtually everything said about AIDS, because the initial information that we received as a matter of historical and scientific fact was lies. So from day one, on who discovered AIDS, and was it the French virus or the American virus, it was the French virus. And our entire Cancer Institute involved, at least that the entirety of those who are aware of the problem, went along with a lie. And the National Institutes of Health, that is the overseer of the National Cancer Institute, helped cover it all up. So from top to bottom, there was one big lie with one big cover-up. Now, most Americans are not aware of this. As a result, they will accept that, gee, HIV is a virus, and if you have the antibody, you're going to get the disease, and you get the disease, you're going to die, and you can only take these antiretroviral cocktails, and AZT, and DDI, and DDC, and other things. Well, what if the beginning of this whole scenario is a lie? Why should we have any more confidence in their integrity to tell us the truth later on? We've already seen what they're doing for money, and lots of it, both individually and for the fame and financing that comes with it. So I will go on. If you've just joined us, I'm Gary Knoll. Part 5 of AIDS, A Second Opinion, Deconstructing the Myth of HIV and AIDS. In our previous discussions, we've wondered whether, given the nature of retroviruses in the immune system, HIV could really be behind AIDS. We looked at the nature of retroviruses, the posted reasons for HIV's long incubation, and the status of T cells when a person is dying of AIDS, among other topics. We held off treating what might be considered the most basic question of all about HIV. Does it exist? If it does exist, does it have any strong connection to AIDS? I will put off the first question, picking it up when we're a little further along in our series on retroviruses and scientific technique. The second question is simple enough. While its ramifications are about as unsettling to the orthodox as could be. At the very beginning of my series, I brought up what to me is a telling metaphor. The thought of a man arrested for murder simply because he was found at the site of a violence. HIV has been found in many AIDS patients, while not found in healthy humans. All this really proves is that HIV has some, but not necessarily a causative relationship to the disease. It could be a byproduct of immunosuppressive suppression created by some other means. Perhaps you've seen the French film Moon in the Gutter, based upon the work by the American hard-boiled writer David Godes. In it, the hero's sister is raped and murdered. The police have neither leads nor hope for solving the crime. The despairing brother, finding his own investigation equally futile, begins going over every night to stand on the corner where the body was found. Should he be arrested for the crime? In other words, guilt is not the only reason one may be in the vicinity. This holds also for disease. Observance of the presence of particular accompanying conditions in a sick person do not tell us anything about why those conditions appear. In that part, we want to talk a little more about correlation. This is also the place where we will scrutinize a couple of other points that weaken the HIV is the cause of AIDS argument. Cases in which people have AIDS but not HIV, or who have HIV in their body but never seem to come down with AIDS. Let's talk first about the correlation-only evidence. The fact that HIV has only been linked with HIV by correlation, that is, by seeing both are present in most patients who have come down with the illness, is not an elaborate or difficult to understand thesis, and so does not lend itself to obfuscation. In other cases, as when a dissenter attacks orthodoxy or the inability of scientists to isolate the HIV retrovirus, for example, establishment doctors, as you will see, can argue with sophisticated presentations that a new method of isolation, because of its greater discriminatory power, has supplanted the older one. The layperson who is following the debate may not feel up to challenging dogma on this thorny issue. However, the topic of correlation comes down to elementary logic. Either the establishment has other evidence, or it is resting its case simply on correlation. And correlation won't do. Since on this front, correlation seems to be the only arrow this establishment expert have in their quiver. When confronted with questions about this recourse, their recourse is to fall back on talking about the subject, ignoring the questioner, handling out patiently sophic answers. In this reporting on the case, Serge Lang in Yale Scientific notes that leading dissenters, Duisberg, Mullis, have both asked Montagnier and Gallo and others who have erected the establishment's view of HIV as the only cause of AIDS for papers, quote, showing any scientific justification that HIV causes a disease. They asked for such papers, but none were forthcoming, unquote. Mullis took the bull by the horns and spoke to Montagnier directly. In Lang's article in the Yale Scientific magazine, he said, quote, in San Diego, after Montagnier had given a talk on AIDS, Dr. Curry Mullis noticed that Montagnier hadn't said one word about why we ought to think HIV is the cause of AIDS. After the talk, Mullis asked Montagnier directly for a scientific reference, and Montagnier admitted that, quote, none existed, unquote. More indirectly, Duisberg met the same stonewalling. Duisberg wrote a letter dated February 11, 1993, to Dr. Harold Jaffe, director of the HIV-AIDS division of the CDC. In that letter, Duisberg asked exactly what papers are now considered proof, or if there is no proof, the best support for the HIV equals AIDS hypothesis. Not a single scientific paper was mentioned in Jaffe's reply. Jaffe only gave what he viewed as epidemiological evidence. In an article by Dr. Curry Mullis and others in the magazine Reason, they make clear that correlation is a very thin reed on which to support the causal link between the disease and the retrovirus, especially in light of the absence of an animal model. That is, an example of an animal being infected by a like virus and coming down with like disease. This has never happened, ever. And as I mentioned earlier, if you read any newspaper account about 10 years ago, where they finally had one single animal come down with a virus, it was only after they first destroyed the body of that animal with chemotherapy. Well, then that was a setup. That was fraud. You cannot use that as legitimate science to say that then the virus caused the disease, because it had never been able to cause the disease in any animal model, which is the virus alone. And so depressing the immune system to make the virus seem as if it were the cause, that doesn't wash. It's not legitimate. All that those behind HIV as a cause have to prove their hypothesis is correlation. But as the Reason article said, quote, very sick persons with damaged immune systems carry many microbes, and it's impossible with correlation studies alone to prove that a particular microbe is the effective cause of the syndrome rather than a mere passenger, unquote. Let me give you an example of this, something that I'm sure many of you who've listened to this program over the years would appreciate. You go to your doctor, the doctor gives you a checkup and says, you're all right. Now, you may be overweight. You could have multiple viruses and bacteria, but none are at that moment manifesting. Maybe their stress level in your life is not particularly high. Maybe you're taking some vitamins. But then you go through a period of time where you go through some highly stressful event. And it's generally a highly stressful event, an acute stressful event that will cause your immune system to tumble. Now you go back to the doctor and you're sick. Now the doctor finds you have hepatitis C, you have herpes, cytomegala, Coxsackie mycoplasma. Now, the doctor will try to say that it is the virus or the microbe or the hepatitis that made you sick. Can't do that. Not plausible. That's the kind of argument they've been making with AIDS. That's the kind of discriminatory mental churning that they use to try to show causal reactions. Nope. The mere presence of the virus cannot be shown to be the cause of the illness. Indeed, when you look at your stress, you've had those viruses all along, but you didn't come down with the sickness. We all have strep in our throat. We have staph in our throat, but we all don't get sore throats until you get stressed. And then the next day you come down with a sore throat. That's what it means to have multiple pathogens. So you could say then that the immune system was depressed by the stress, which then allowed activation of multiple cofactors. Now, would you have been equally sick if you only had one virus? If you just had hepatitis, just had herpes, just had... The answer would be no. But we don't have just one microbe in our body. We have thousands of microbes. And plus all the hormone adjustments. So when they're trying to say that HIV by itself will cause 30 different conditions, from pneumocystis pneumonia, which has never been shown to cause, not a single model ever, to cervical cancer. And it has nothing in the world to do with cervical cancer. But it was a good way to get all women who would have cervical cancer into the figures to artificially elevate how many people have AIDS to keep the funding going. Anything to keep the money pouring. In an earlier newspaper article by the same authors, a vast discrepancy is highlighted between the cottage industry churning out articles on AIDS, many on minuscule and secondary issues. For example, in Woolgar and Latour terms, examples of scientific building on each other's credibility claims, all of which accept the holy writ that HIV is the villain in the AIDS drama, and the paucity of attempts to come to grips with the outstanding problem of what proof there is that HIV really is culpable. Although more than 75,000 scientific papers have been published on AIDS at that time, they say, quote, no paper has seriously considered all relevant evidence and attempted to prove that HIV causes AIDS, unquote. This certainly says little for the willingness of the orthodox majority to take on different tasks, let alone for their ambition in that, quote, if such a paper were possible to write, it would have been written and been the most widely cited scientific publication in this century, unquote. Which is also to say that this absence of such an article proving HIV causes AIDS strongly hints that such a paper cannot be written, since the causative role of HIV is non-existent. To summarize and restress the importance of this point, let's listen to Dr. Ruth Bernstein. We must be absolutely certain that HIV is not epiphenomenon of AIDS before we assert that it is the primary cause. The fact is that an extremely frequent finding in AIDS patients is not logically compelling. It is only suggestive. Other infections, such as cytomegalovirus, are also nearly universal among AIDS patients. If both are correlated with AIDS, which is the cause? Or are both viruses reactivated by previous and perhaps more diverse causes of immune suppression? How do we know what is cause and what is effect? Let's take a look at HIV without AIDS. One reason to doubt whether HIV causes AIDS is the fact that many people who have been diagnosed as HIV positive never become sick. The editors of Rethinking AIDS point out that approximately 75% of American hemophiliacs who have been HIV positive for over 7 years, and yet only 2% annually develop AIDS indicator diseases. According to accepted predictions about the incubation period, about 50% should have developed AIDS, not 2%. 2%, not 50. Moreover, the deaths of the HIV infected should have gone in the same direction, increasing in the same direction as the patients became older. Instead, there's been a widely skewed distribution. As Dr. David Rasnick reports, quote, although HIV is widespread in American European hemophiliacs, the death rate of hemophiliacs has decreased, while that for male homosexuals increased, and that for intravenous drug users stayed for about the same. If HIV were the cause of AIDS, the death rate of all infected groups should have followed the same curve. It did not. There are also incidents of HIV-positive homosexual men who have remained healthy for over 15 years. Further, in experiments, chimps repeatedly inoculated with HIV in an attempt to create an animal model never developed the syndrome. So let's dwell on those experiments a minute. There has been much talk in the mass media about the existence of an animal virus in monkeys that in some way parallels the human type and disease-causing effect. However, a close examination of the scientific literature reveals that no such parallel virus disease exists, and furthermore, trying to give AIDS to animals have proven fruitless. As a number of scientists point out in Reason, quote, the absence of an animal model, that is, causes cases of animals with a disease similar to AIDS, is not cured by tall tales about the so-called simian immunovirus. The monkey disease called SIV does not resemble AIDS. They claim, since unlike AIDS, SIV, or simian virus 40, follows the primary infection closely and does not occur after a latency period of 10 years. Thus, it is like other short-term viruses. Moreover, they point out this virus only sickens laboratory animals, who are often weakened by being taken from their natural habitat. They go on, the same retrovirus is found in wild populations, causing no illness. Now, since the parallels between HIV and AIDS are limited, scientists have tried to infect animals directly. As a writer in the Miami Herald mentions, quote, scientists have stuck all kinds of mice and rats and monkeys and chimpanzees with HIV, and none of them have gotten anything to resemble human AIDS. Dr. Paul Philpott draws our attention to how desperate researchers have become to produce AIDS in animals through HIV infection. One experiment followed infected chimps for more than 10 years. Quote, when none of the 150 or so HIV-positive chimps developed AIDS after 10 years, that should have falsified the official view, unquote. Philpott notes, however, instead, the primates' experiments were continued into their 11th year. Eventually, one chimp grew sick with some symptoms resembling AIDS, although these conditions might have been attributed to age. The chimps in the experiment were about 15 years of age, many growing close to the end of their natural life expectancy. So, quote, at some point, they are bound to start losing body mass and mental capacity and becoming susceptible to opportunistic infections such as pneumonia, just like aging humans. Philpott wonders if their deaths by natural causes and then may be willfully attributed to the effect of the original HIV infection. There seems to be no other way than for this flawed one to be used to justify continuing to do research on animals. When I interviewed Dr. Kerry Mullis, he brought up an article in Nature, which reports on another group that has had HIV for a long period of time, but no death or disease. Further, it shows the length science will go to ignore what would seem the obvious suggestions of their own findings. You would think that if HIV-positive people were not getting AIDS, as predicted, this would shake their belief in the HIV equals AIDS equation, but instead, they weaseled out of this deduction. He told me this and said the following. This article named 15 doctors who studied the prostitutes in some little Eastern African country above Liberia. They had gone there 5 years before and found 75% of the prostitutes were HIV positive. They predicted if they came back in 5 years, half of them would be dead. So they came back in 5 years, and there were no bodies to count, no dead prostitutes to do autopsies on. They were still HIV positive, according to the test, and all were alive. And the conclusion of the paper was that when that should have told them that HIV doesn't seem to be hurting these people, the conclusion was these people have a special strain of HIV, which, number one, does not cause any disease. Number two, it protects you from strains rampant throughout the rest of Africa. I mean, a sixth grader, I think, looking at the logic there, would say, wait a minute, these guys, the emperor has no clothes here. Being HIV positive without developing AIDS in itself does not discount causation. It may only suggest a longer than expected incubation period. What is more damaging to the case for HIV is this reverse scenario. People have what looks like AIDS while being HIV negative. There are ample documented cases for this. As we will see, these cases reach back to the very first reports of AIDS, though understandably the establishment is not eager to let you know this. You don't see these things published. They're quite prevalent in Africa, and moreover, the finding of such cases throws new doubt upon one of the prevalent practices in AIDS autopsies. A person dies of AIDS, judging from the symptoms, and so the doctor lists him as HIV positive, presuming he or she has the retrovirus, without actually testing for the presence of the virus or antibody. This procedure would be respectable if 100% of those dying of AIDS have been found to be HIV positive. Now, since this is not the case, and since most people you can never ever find the virus in, even who die of full-blown AIDS, you cannot find a single virus in them, then what are they trying to cause in the way of a camouflage here? Look at all the deviations to their theory. These cases had all the AIDS-defining illnesses, the characteristic drop in CD4 cells, but no HIV or antibodies to HIV. The Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta eventually called an emergency meeting to discuss the cases. The upshot was the disease AIDS without HIV was renamed idiopathic CD4 lymphocytopenia. What's that mean? Well, that's just a clever little smoke and mirrors turning the terminology that says, yes, they had AIDS, but they didn't have HIV. Yeah, but they said HIV was the cause of AIDS. Without HIV, you can't have AIDS. Well, that's the nice thing about working for the CDC. You can just make up anything you want, and nobody challenges it. Mind you, these are still the same wunderkinds that gave us the Tuskegee experiment. They had no problems with lies and deceptions and watching human beings die of syphilis that they could have cured. So should it surprise us as these same people who have had no compunction to use a moral equation of any integrity should lack integrity and being so disingenuous to say that, yeah, they died of AIDS, but they didn't have HIV because they had a kind of AIDS that you don't get HIV, and don't ask us anything more because we're not equipped to answer it. Well, unfortunately, the mainstream media never asked them the question. We are. And in our next report, we're going to go deeper into this. And we're going to start deconstructing every single argument that tries to prove that HIV is a cause of AIDS. And when you see the evidence, you may be of a different mind. I'm Gary Noll. I'd like to thank you for listening to the program today. This is part 5 of our AIDS A Second Opinion, Deconstructing the Myth of HIV and AIDS. Have